We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/lawless. Just go to Indeed.com/lawless right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/lawless. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
To all you Berhalter haters out there, just sheathe those knives for now. Don't worry. Fear not. You are going to get an opportunity because summer is coming. Hello, Sunshine. I'm Alexi Lawless, and welcome to the State of the Union podcast, where we look at the beautiful game on and off the field through the lens of red, white, and blue colored glasses. This show will be talking a U.S. men's national team recap, the fallacy of form, never Gregors, Brazil rebirth, the chant Nickelodeon, the German swoosh, punk soccer, and so much more. But first, joining me as always, my friend, my colleague, my guiding light, David Mossy, a soccer savant and a Fox soccer researcher and writer extraordinaire. Mossy, how are you doing on this Monday, March 25th in the year 2024?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back in the studio.
It is good to be back in the studio, and we have cause for celebration. We come at you here Monday morning, the day after yet another victory when it comes to U.S. and Mexico. We'll get to that in a second, but first, did you watch anything, my friend?
For the last week, my life has been a documentary orgy.
Ooh, okay.
I finished The Bomb in the Cold War, which I thought was sensational. I then watched that Flamengo Fire documentary, Nino do Urubu. And I also watched The Octopus Murders. And I then went back and listened to the pod a couple weeks ago to see what you had said about that pod. And I agree with you 100%. Two all over the place, doesn't really come together at the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tinfoil flying around. And sometimes the tinfoil is okay. We talked last week about the Daily Plaza and my visit to Dallas. Yeah, this one, I mean, it's in the name, the octopus, because it's all of these tentacles that go out all over the place. But some of them, a lot of them don't connect, and it makes it confusing and complex. All right. But you liked the Brazilian one? I mean, as much as you like a horrible tragedy that's being documented.
Yeah, it was well done.
Okay. I'm gonna check that one out, because I had mentioned that to you before, but I have yet to see it. The only thing that I have is I watched Quiet on Set. This is a documentary about the Nickelodeon era from the 90s into the aughts, if you will. And yes, all of the success, but the adults behind the scene that were responsible for it and just some, you know, really bad behavior and criminal behavior at different times. And I thought it was good. I'm not sure it was great. Well, one of the main protagonists in this, I actually grew up watching as an actor, and then he became a director and a writer, and really the almost a Svengali type of presence for a lot of these young actors and actresses. And I feel like at this point over the years, the story has been told so many times about the pitfalls and the problems in the moment, and then as related going forward to these young actors and actresses that get into acting, like I said, at a very early age, that like at some point the lesson has to be learned by each and every generation that has seen this story play out time and time again. And yet the allure of Hollywood, I get it. And for parents, you know, whether it's a way out for them and their kids, or they're living a dream that the parents had or whatever it is, I get that that's powerful. But, you know, the lack of accountability when it comes to, you know, some of the parenting out there is disappointing too.
I haven't watched it yet. I will, but this was highly recommended by Kat. If there is a deeply disturbing documentary out there, she'll find it.
She will find it. Yeah, she was very excited to talk about it when we came in today. And I think, you know, we disagree a little bit. And again, there is a whole generation, producer Sean is part of this, that grew up in that 90s era of Nickelodeon, where Nickelodeon was everything. And it's amazing to see how they framed it off of, you know, for example, having the Kids' Choice Awards or the, you know, Nickelodeon Awards and all that, and they framed it off of the Oscars and, you know, the way that they wrote these things and how it appealed to kids. And, you know, you're using a lens going back and looking at stuff that happened. And that's where I think a lot of people see the problematic things that were done by adults, either to these children and these child actors or in the context of a child TV production. And I get a lot of it, and a lot of it is appalling and completely unjustified. But there's also a lot of it that's kind of, sour grapes and looking back. And it's just a little weird sometimes attaching things from so far away to stuff that happened back in the time. We can all look back and say this is wrong or this is wrong, and So there's a lot of that. Should we light this candle, my friend?
Let's do it.
All right. Where should we get to? Like, I don't know.
We begin with the U.S. men's national team, who last night captured their third straight CONCACAF Nations League title, beating Mexico 2-0 in the final. The goals, Tyler Adams late in the first half, Gio Reyna in the second half. The U.S. now unbeaten in their last 7 games against Mexico, 5 wins and 2 draws.
All right. Can I preface our conversation here, Mossy? Because there is a sentiment out there, I'm sure, that people that believe that talking about this, it's very easy to lose perspective. I want to make sure that everybody understands what we're about to do here on the State of the Union. We're not breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back for beating Mexico. And by the way, beating Mexico yet again. But this is a trophy. This is a moment of celebration. This is a moment where the music and the confetti and the raising of the trophy happens. That is important. I think that is worthy of celebration. This is also a comprehensive win against our biggest rival within CONCACAF in what has to be said was a hostile environment down there in Arlington, Texas, where, you know, whatever, 60,000 fans, and they were obviously there to see Mexico. And, you know, a lot of love again to AO, the American Outlaws out there, and they did the best that they could. So we will, I think, fairly and rightfully so, celebrate this win. And then I think whether it's the players, Greg Berhalter, or any of us on the outside, get back to the work at hand and recognize and respect that there are bigger fish to fry. Having said that, this, as I said, was a comprehensive win. Congratulations to Greg Berhalter and to this team. I think that watching this game in that 90 minutes, there was no doubt as to who the better team was, individually in terms of the talent and collectively in terms of a team. And they smashed our rivals, Mexico, yet again. 2-0. It never gets old. If it gets old, then something is wrong. We might talk a little bit about that rivalry and where it's going and that pendulum that we talk about a lot right now. But certainly, this is, at least for me, cause for celebration with perspective.
First off, I want to give a shout out to Chris Whittingham, who I thought did a great job calling both U.S. matches alongside Tony Miola. He has a very distinct voice that you couldn't mistake for anybody else.
You're being so facetious there. You want to explain to the folks?
I mistakenly referred to him as Dre Cordero on our last podcast, which yes, Tony Miola let me know about.
My good friend Tony Miola was very quick to say, hey, not for nothing. But and so we have corrected that. Congratulations to Chris and Tony. I actually think that they did a really good job. All right, listen, Mossy, can I take you through the 11 and just some real thoughts on what's happening? Or you wanted to say something before?
I just want to get one big picture thought in there. I feel like we had this exact conversation last year after the U.S. beat Mexico 3-0 in the Nations League semis. The gap between these two teams right now is huge to the point where Mexico is the one that tries to muck up the game while the U.S. is the one that tries to play. And a pretty good 7 out of 10 performance is now enough to beat Mexico comfortably. That's where we are in this rivalry. I have some thoughts on how we ended up there. But, you know, I think people are going to have to wrap their heads around the fact that Mexico is no longer a barometer for the U.S. Yes, these games have extra juice. Yes, it's more satisfying to beat Mexico than it is to beat a Jamaica or Panama. But from a technical standpoint, if the goal, as people like you keep saying, over the next couple of years is to become an elite team that can arrive at the next World Cup feeling like a legitimate contender to win it, then Mexico is no longer a litmus test in that regard.
Okay. So you're doing exactly what I just told you we weren't going to do. You're such a grouch. And again, it doesn't mean that you're being delusional or Pollyanna in the way that we're talking about it to celebrate this win. All right, when I go through the 11, Matt Turner, I think reestablished himself as the number one, but to your point, was not tested a whole lot and obviously let in a goal in the first 7 seconds. And as you mentioned in a previous pod, there were some shaky moments, especially with him playing out of the back. But again, this is a guy who is not playing. We'll get into that in a second. Serginho Dest comes back into the fold in that right back position. I think Serginho Dest approached this game as an opportunity to create as much content for the gram as possible, because the stuff that he was doing was wonderful and it was beautiful and it was audacious and it was great to see. And from a viral perspective, I'm sure that his Instagram feed is now full of moments.
It is a roller coaster with him though, because defensively, some of the lapses, that play in the second half where he let Henry Martin push him off the ball in the box and get a shot off, I mean, that can't happen.
Yeah, you take the good with the bad when it comes to Serginho Dest. And I think that there is more good than bad. However, you know, I was talking to my brother last night, and it's not good and the bad. It's great or bad. And there's very little in between. As we go down the line, Chris Richards got the start again. I still don't think that he is good enough. I still have not seen enough from him. From a defensive standpoint, I think he's shaky. He doesn't give a whole lot going forward. So I think the jury is still out when it comes to him. Tim Ream came back in and just showed what a mature, evolved, playmaking type of center back is and how important he is in a situation like this. And I'll just reference back to what we said earlier on the pod last week. This is a very different type of team that the U.S. was facing, in that Mexico wasn't going to go into a shell and defend like Jamaica. And so there was much more space for the talent to do what they needed to do and for the ball handling, whether it's Tim Ream or anybody else out there, to have that time and space to do it. Anthony Robson, I think, was much better in this game. Weston McKennie is such an interesting player. I love him. I thought that his confidence and his swagger out there was the best part of when he had the ball. He believed, and he made me believe, that he was not going to lose it. And that was important. Tyler Adams goes without saying. You come in, you only play 45 minutes, but you score a crucial goal, and one that nobody would have predicted he would have scored. But more importantly, his leadership and the impact that his presence on the field cannot be overstated.
Keep going.
Okay, keep going. Reyna, let me come back to Reyna. I did not think that Timmy Weah had a good window. I did not think that Yunus Musah, who, by the way, didn't start, had a good window. And maybe there are extenuating circumstances when it comes to Ramadan and the fasting and all that. Haji Wright, I think, showed that he was okay, but not great. And I don't think anybody has changed anybody's mind in that number nine position still remains wide open. It's a pity that we didn't get to see Josh Sargent in this window. Christian Pulisic, I thought, was arguably the best player over these two games. But I know, really, when it comes to what we're talking about here, it's Gio Reyna starting, and Gio Reyna having a consistent positive impact on this team. Mossy.
And doing it in front of his parents, who were in attendance.
That was great. That was great TV work for the camera to go and show Claudio and Danielle up there in the stands, given all of the drama and what has played out over the last year and a half.
All right, two big picture thoughts on the starting lineup. Haji Wright's trajectory is fascinating to me. The guy barely plays in the lead up to the World Cup and then ends up going to Qatar and being on the field for the most pivotal moments of that campaign. Then he seemingly drops out of the picture again. He wasn't in the original squad for these games, which contained three center forwards. He was not one of them, but he ends up starting the final against Mexico. And I do think Balogun has run out of rope as far as being the default starter. Now, he's obviously still in the mix. I think he's the most talented player in that mix. So my money is on him reemerging as a starter. But I do think it was notable that in a final against Mexico, Balogun and Pepe both available, neither one started. Haji Wright did. So to your point, that center forward position is wide open. Again, the next games for the U.S. are against Colombia and Brazil right before the Copa America. I have no idea who's going to start up front in those games.
Do you think that had Haji Wright not come on and scored those two goals against Jamaica, that he would have been starting this game?
No, I think that's what got him in the starting lineup.
Okay. All right. I mean, well, and we talked about the difference between coming on as a sub and actually starting. And he wasn't horrible. There were a couple offside that I was scratching my head at. But yeah, you know, just go back to what you said. It's still wide open right now.
And then my second big picture point is we've been talking about it. The U.S. has six starters for five positions, those two wing positions and the three in the midfield, Adams, McKinney, Musa, Reyna, Pulisic, Weah. And there was going to come a day when everybody was going to be available and it was going to be an important match and someone was going to be the odd man out. And it was Musa. Now, maybe it had to do with Ramadan, but I do find it interesting that because of his indifferent season with AC Milan and his recent games for the U.S. haven't been that great, I didn't notice a lot of controversy on X over Musa not starting that game. Could you see this as being permanent, where he becomes more of a backup for the U.S., and is that odd man out?
Only because it specifically relates to Gio Reyna, and so many people want Gio Reyna to be on the field. And again, against a different opponent, you know, while Mexico certainly believes that and showed that they want to play and they're not going to bunker in or anything like that, this is also a very different proposition than coming up against the Netherlands. And so, yeah, I think the equation in Greg Berhalter's head changes dramatically relative to the opponent. But here, you know, he knew the U.S. was going to have the ball. He knew there were going to be spaces. And Gio Reyna had played well in the previous game. And so starting him, I think made sense, especially given the fact that Musa had not played well.
And the fact that Adams had 45 minutes in him and Greg Berhalter opted to go with him in the first half rather than the second half to kind of set the tone is interesting. Had he not scored that goal and we had gone in 0-0 and then he comes off at the half and Johnny comes in, we might be having a different conversation today about that decision. But the fact that he scored that goal makes it seem like a brilliant move.
Okay, so let's get down to Berhalter here. You were really, really good in our spaces, and if you didn't listen to it, it's in your feed, talking about the negativity and the criticism and, or, I mean, it's a harsh word, but the hate relative to Greg Berhalter, and that there are the never Gregors out there. And your point was, and I'm just paraphrasing here, that if you didn't think Greg Berhalter should have been the coach after the World Cup, then nothing is going to change your mind, and that's just the way that it is. But when it comes to Greg Berhalter, it has to be said, people scream and yell about what he isn't doing, or he's not making enough changes, or he's not adjusting, or he's not playing X player or X player. And then in this, a final, when he does adjust and does play different people and does have, you know, Gio Reyna or, you know, a controversial type of selection where he plays Tyler Adams and starts him there, and it goes well, and not just goes well, goes really, really well individually for the players and the team collectively in terms of the result and the overall performance, well, that's just because he's been given the greatest collection of talent of any coach in history. So he can't win. To all you Berhalter haters out there, just sheath those knives for now. Don't worry. Fear not. You are going to get an opportunity because summer is coming. All right. Another chance for you to plunge those knives deep into Greg Berhalter and bathe in that Schadenfreude is going to come soon enough. But until then, as I mentioned at the top of the show, just relax and enjoy another win over Mexico. Because as I said, it never, ever gets old. And again, we are approaching this with perspective. But even in the post-game show, the way that it was framed was, okay, yeah, but this is just Mexico. Okay, yeah, but Greg Berhalter really didn't do anything. And look, I got a lot of respect for Jesse Marsh for what he has done. And he wasn't the only one, but a lot of people in particular were pointing out the way that Gio Reyna was playing and dropping deep to get the ball. And whether that was a tactical decision or whether that was just the flow of the game. Well, first off, if you ever kicked the ball, and certainly Jesse Marsh and everybody else on that panel and around the world, I'm assuming you've kicked the ball at some point. You've been in a game where a center midfielder, a creative type, has wanted to get the ball. Now, it does drive me crazy when midfielders come back and take the ball off of center back's feet, but I understand why they do it. They want to get on the ball. They want to be involved. And they are in there to run the show. And Gio Reyna was in there to run the show. But I just thought it was kind of nitpicking, and I didn't think that it was I didn't think it made the point that people wanted to make to go and say, well, why is Gio Reyna showing up in strange places as opposed to getting closer to the goal? Well, one of the reasons is we want him to have the ball, and he was looking to actually get the ball.
And again, on Greg Berhalter, you can either live in the world as it is or the world that you think it should be. And the world as it is that Matt Crocker really likes Greg Berhalter, clearly, mm-hmm. and thinks he did a good job in the last cycle, which is why he rehired him. And the players really like Greg Berhalter. You saw what Yunus Musa said before these games. You saw what Tyler Adams said after the game last night, lavishing praise on Berhalter. So clearly the threshold of how much it's going to take for him to lose his job is higher than fans on X think it should be. You and I have talked about it. I think it would take a catastrophic Copa America campaign, an embarrassing group stage exit. If he gets out of that group, which does contain Panama and Bolivia, and whatever happens in a knockout stage, I think he's fine and he'll keep going after that. So fans just better reconcile themselves to that.
Can I read you a little quote from Greg Berhalter? Doug McIntyre put this out here on X when Greg Berhalter was asked, Tyler Adams was asked about Greg Berhalter. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but Tyler Adams talking about Greg Berhalter, he's doing more for us as a country in developing us as young players than people see, obviously, on the field. It's not easy to come into camp and have 2 days to train. Some guys played 90 minutes and get in a day before the game and have to play again. So this camp was a success. And I think we need to continue to have more moments like this. To your point, and then he also said, what are you as fans or press judging him off of? You know what I mean? We continue to win in certain situations. Our first World Cup experience was a positive in a lot of people's minds. Greg Berhalter is developing us in the right way. He's having conversations with us off the pitch that are continually developing us. And most importantly, he's challenging us. Now, this is a Greg Berhalter who also in the post-game conference said that he got into a fight with Tyler Adams, you know, a shouting match with Tyler Adams because Tyler Adams wanted to continue on and not just play 45 minutes. We saw Tyler Adams come off the field and them get into it on the sideline out there. But to your point, these players seem to have a respect and a fondness and do like Greg Berhalter. And I know those will say, well, yeah, if he's starting them and he's giving them time on the field, what are they going to say? So, Mossy, go ahead.
Sean Sullivan, for what it's worth, called it a Berhalter masterclass last night and said the fact that he started Tyler Adams and Gio Reyna reflected the fact that he has big balls.
I don't know how big his balls are. I mean, I think some of this kind of wrote itself. And it gets back to, you know, form is fallacy, my friend. You want to go there?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to pin down exactly what form is fallacy means. It certainly applies with Gio because he's somebody whose form has been criticized. And so that spoke to the fact that however poorly a guy might be playing at club level, he can still show up for the national team and do well. But you tried to apply it to Tyler Adams. Yeah. And to me, that's no form. A guy being injured doesn't really apply.
You just told me how there is a sentiment out there that starting Tyler Adams was this ooh-ah type of thing. And if that's the case, why? Well, because this is a guy who hasn't played. And so my question to you is someone that has bad form that is playing, okay, worse or better than someone that has no form at all because he's not playing? Either way, I look at it as this is form, okay? And his form in this situation is fallacy in that he started a guy who has not been playing soccer.
So both cases fit under the general umbrella of form is fallacy.
Yes, they definitely.
But you would agree, the quintessential examples are guys that are playing poorly at club level.
Absolutely. My point is that we cannot always judge what is happening at the club level, whether they are playing and playing poorly, or by the way, whether they are playing and playing well, or in this case, they're not even playing at all. We can't just use that and say, well, that's going to happen immediately when they get into camp. And I think Tyler Adams, in a strange way, was also trying to, you know, talk about that here in that they don't have a whole lot of time. And so whatever history you have, whatever organization you have already put in place, it becomes that much more valuable. And again, it's against Mexico. So we temper all of this with that. But Greg Berhalter, I think, deserves credit and praise for doing things that people disagreed with and doing things that people didn't or doing things that people didn't expect in this moment. And it worked out. And even if Tyler Adams had not scored the goal, it still ended up being the right decision to have him start this game. And certainly when it comes to Gio Reyna, I think it was the right decision specifically in this game against Mexico.
Can I revisit the gap between the U.S. and Mexico right now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mexico coach Jimmy Lozano said this after the match. La diferencia es la cantidad de jugadores que tienen en clubes europeos. El día a día es distinto, la competencia es distinta. For those of you that didn't understand that, please learn Spanish. I mean, it is soon going to become the official language of the United States. But no, as an unapologetic Euro snob, that was music to my ears because that's what I've been saying on this podcast. Mexico has to get over this thing with Liga MX. In the year 2024, if you're a country in the Americas that has illusions of being elite, you have to accept the fact that your national team and your domestic league are going to exist in different ecosystems. And the mere fact that all the players originally came up through their domestic clubs has to be enough to give you a sense of satisfaction, a sense of identification. But I mean, you cannot have their squad 13 of the 23 play in Liga MX, while the US 2 of the 23 play in MLS. So to me, that's a big difference between the two. The European club pedigree of the US squad is just much, much higher right now. Now, every single comment after this Jimmy Lozano quote was some Mexican saying, well, then why did you play Henry Martin over Santi Jimenez, which does sort of contradict his whole premise. Nevertheless, I do think the larger point is correct.
I mean, there's a part of me, the competitive American part of me, that enjoys the meltdown of what is happening here and the introspection and the doubt that it's not just creeping in. It's in full-fledged form right now when it comes to what the national team and what El Tri is.
Yeah, there's just too many Mexican players who are in Liga MX right now who should be in Europe, either because they never went or they went and came back. We see it when we cover the CONCACAF Champions Cup. I'm always watching these games and seeing players and like, oh, wow, he's back in Liga MX. I thought that guy was in Europe. And for me, it's a problem for them. Now, another issue for Mexico is the embarrassing behavior of their fans. Should we go there next?
Yes.
Because this game had to be stopped a couple of times late because of those homophobic chants, which set off all sorts of debate on X. I saw you chiming in on whether that's the best way to handle this. So what say you?
Yeah, I mean, this is unfortunately an evergreen type of problem that we are dealing with. And, you know, as I said on X, I don't know what the answer is, but it does seem, and we saw it again last night, that stopping the game for these 5-minute punishments actually rewards the bad behavior of the crowd by giving them a power over what happens on the field. I also think a couple of things need to be said when it comes to this situation. One, these are Americans. These are fellow Americans that are chanting, all right? Two, and I think this just applies to all cultures, cultures don't like to be told by others what is or isn't appropriate or what they can or cannot do or say. Three, people feel comfortable in this crowd-like situation doing things that they would never do alone. And the punishments that I see in terms of the opinions and suggestions out there as to what should be done, most of it involves punishing the team. Most of it involves punishing the players and the federation. I don't think that that solves anything. If you notice, when this started to happen was when it was clear that it was not going well for Mexico. And I do think that this power that you give the fans in this moment can be incredibly intoxicating. And the result actually becomes inconsequential. So it's part of me says, you know what? And we're going to talk a little bit later here about actual physical violence. And I'm not discounting the importance and the value and the potential pain and hurt that words can cause. But in this instance, it's words. And part of me says, you know what? Do you just ignore it and go on? This is a game played in the United States. We as Americans certainly have the right to police a game, whether it's actions or words in this case, as we see fit. But I don't know, Mossy, how this gets sorted out without punishing the very people, in this case, players and teams, that have nothing to do with it on the field. And I don't want that. I think this rivalry is important. I think it adds to the game. I want Mexico being involved in tournaments, whether it's a Gold Cup, whether it's Nations League, whether it's this summer in Copa America, and certainly when it comes to 26 in the World Cup, and by the way, co-hosting it with us. But I don't see how this changes by doing the things that they're doing right now.
Yeah, it's a tough situation because, to your point, Mexico is such a moneymaker that banning them from tournaments is just not going to happen.
No, exactly. So. Yeah, and you know that, and gets back to a thing. You know, had this game been played in the Azteca, you know, years ago we lost a Gold Cup in Azteca, and it's a very, even though this is an away game, we talk about the crowd there. There's also a very different component if and when games are played in Mexico. And so while you just got done crushing and poo-pooing this version of El Tri right now, and as good as I do think the U.S. is and how much better they are, if the U.S. had gone down and played this game in Azteca or in Guadalajara and lost, I don't think that that would have been out of the realm of possibility. But to your point, this is an ATM machine for a lot of teams, not just Mexican teams and not just national teams. Where should we go now, my friend?
Well, I'll just say we have an Ask Alexi question about beer getting thrown at you, and your one for the road is on this rivalry. So we'll revisit US-Mexico a couple of times.
Yeah.
But we had some other international action. The field for the Copa America is set. The last two teams qualified on Saturday. Canada beat TNT 2-0. Laren and Schaffelberg with the goals. So they slot into a group with Argentina, Chile, and Peru, and they will face Argentina in the opening match of the tournament June 20th in Atlanta.
Good luck with that, our friends to the Great White North. But it's a better tournament having Canada in it. Canada is going through a really interesting time. The highest of highs, finally qualifying again for the Men's World Cup, and yet off the field, all sorts of problems right now. And at a point where it should all be wonderful and exciting and there should be incredible growth and there should be incredible focus leading up to 2026, I feel like, unlike the U.S., Canada has has taken 2026 and made it an albatross around their neck and decided to go the completely opposite way. It's very, very difficult. We talk so much about, you know, this signpost and this ramp up to 2026. And yet Canada, man, so let's hope they turn things around from a competitive standpoint on the field. And maybe that starts this summer.
And then Costa Rica beat Honduras 3-1. Both those matches, by the way, were at Toyota Stadium in Frisco, Texas. The Ticos slot into a group with Brazil, Colombia, and Paraguay. Their opening match will be against Brazil at SoFi.
Yeah, a little disappointed in Honduras because we've talked over the last couple of years of what Costa Rica isn't, and really kind of long in the teeth and a pale type of version relative to previous Costa Rican teams that we've seen. But they got the job done, like you said, came back. And, you know, we'll see if a new version of Costa Rica shows up this summer and beyond.
Speaking of Brazil, we had a couple of glamour friendlies on Saturday. Brazil beat England 1-0 at Wembley live on Fox. Dorival Jr. with a victorious debut on the Brazil bench. 17-year-old Endrick came on and scored a late winner. Brazil play tomorrow against Spain at the Bernabeu. You're not going to get me to drop any big Brazil takes before that match. So we'll see how that goes.
You're holding you're keeping your powder dry for that.
On Wednesday, when we wrap up this window, we can really get into Brazil. I will say, though, I was pleasantly surprised. Maybe the sky isn't falling completely.
Okay, just so people have context, I want to read you a little paragraph. You know, the great David Mossy does so much wonderful work behind the scenes to make us look even halfway intelligent. And I just want to read you part of his research notes that he had sent out before the game. Quote, "Between the shortcomings of the talent pool, ineptitude of coaching, incompetence of the federation, and inanity of the media, this is the worst I've ever felt about the Brazilian national team. Brazil is in dire need of a DOS reboot, but lacks the intellectual capacity to confront its current problems, end quote. David Mossy. Now, this is before the Brazil game. Never has such a personal and biased type of writing been made in what ostensibly is a research pack. I love it. I love it so much because you could just feel your passion and your angst when it comes to this team. Now, they go out, and as we said before, even with all of this, they find a way to beat England. Now, having watched the game and done the game on Fox, it wasn't a smash and grab. It wasn't a, oh my goodness, the soccer gods just happened to smile on Brazil. I thought that defensively they were sound. I thought that they created multiple opportunities. And this is against, you know, one of the elites of the world. So Mossy, is this just covering up cracks in the same way that we talk about perspective? Do we need to have perspective in this game because it's still just a friendly?
Well, I think my big picture narratives about Brazil remain. You look at that lineup, the names don't pop. Brazil don't have the high-end talent they used to, which is going to make it exceedingly tougher to win World Cups. But I always said the coaching situation was exacerbating the problem. Having a permanent coach finally, this England match was Brazil's first match under a permanent manager since the World Cup quarterfinal against Croatia 15 months ago. And having a guy that could actually think about how he wanted to set up the team and scout players and do a proper job already made a big difference. The reintegration of Lucas Paquetá was huge. And so, yeah, I finally see a path to us becoming at least a pretty good team and not the disaster that we've been for the last 12 months.
Well, we'll also see if this was an anomaly, just one of those days where everything went right for Brazil because they're going to have their hands full with España.
Endrick became the fourth youngest scorer in Brazil history. This was Brazil's first win at Wembley since a 3-1 victory in the summer of 1995. A teenage Ronaldo was among the scorers that day. Warren Barton featured in that match. And at the final whistle, he swapped jerseys with Edmundo. A couple of years ago, he very generously gifted me that Edmundo jersey. And then on Saturday, when I came in, he gifted me, what is that called? The pennant that you get if you make an international appearance?
Yeah, there you go.
So I now have two souvenirs from that match, Brazil's 3-1 win over England at Wembley in 95.
That is so nice. That's so nice of the great Warren Barton to give you that. All right, so You're cautiously optimistic after this, but obviously things can change rapidly.
We'll see how the Spain match goes. That's fascinating because it's at the Bernabeu. Mm-hmm. So for Vinicius, Rodrigo, and Endrick, who's going to be joining Real Madrid this summer, that's a special occasion for them. We'll see how they react.
Keep in mind that from a U.S. perspective, the U.S. will face Brazil in the lead up to Copa America and then potentially in Copa America if all goes the way it's written up in terms of groups. They could potentially face them also in a knockout stage type of game. So we might see a lot of Brazil going forward.
Also on Saturday, Germany played France off the field in Lyon. They won 2-0. Wirtz in the opening minute and then Havertz early in the second half. The Wirtz
opening
goal,
minute?
The Wirtz goal assisted by Toni Kroos, who came out of international retirement. You've been bullish on Germany despite their recent struggles. You say it's still Germany. They're at home this summer for the Euros. And so count out Germany at your own peril, and you're looking pretty smart, my friend.
Yeah, when we were on air over the weekend, we were talking big picture and the summer that's coming, and you know, I was going through some of the, you know, the big storylines that I was interested to follow. And one of them was Germany. You mentioned reboot and type of thing. Well, maybe a resurrection of Germany, and this does nothing to dampen, you know, my spirits or my belief in that they can do good things. And it did it against what a lot of people feel is the best team in the world in France, arguably. This was, I think, big for the collective conscience and for the confidence of this team and the fact that they are playing at home. And we've seen in the past how that can buoy any team, including in the past how it can help a team like Germany. So I remain not cautiously optimistic. I remain optimistic that Germany can do some good things. And this is exactly what the doctor ordered. Now, you don't, like we said against the U.S., when U.S. played Jamaica, you don't draw up a goal in the first 10 seconds of a game. But there was a kickoff type of play that was run. And, I guess in that sense, you have to give Germany credit for right off the bat seeing some sort of vulnerability and then obviously you hit a shot that you're, you know, 100 times probably not going to be able to hit. So congratulations to Germany. Let's hope there is more of this from my perspective going through this summer. Because like I said, I think Germany in Germany is going to be a story in and of itself.
If I asked you right now, Germany or England, who has a better chance to win the Euros this summer? Conventional wisdom is that France and England are the co-favorites, head and shoulders above the rest. But I feel like you put Germany right in there.
If it's Germany playing against England in Germany in the Euros, I'm taking Germany. You know, I know it's real early days, but right now, you're safe money given the talent. And I don't think that the England result against Brazil is necessarily indicative of, oh gosh, these are cracks and this is a big problem. They're missing a bunch of players. They got plenty of talent. I'm not worried about England going forward. They are going to be, and rightfully so, one of the favorites when it comes to this summer and 26 for that matter.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Now, Germany made some news off the field. Sean Sullivan called this shocking news in the rundown. Germany switching from Adidas to Nike. They've been an Adidas team for decades. So people in the apparel world were floored by this.
You can't seem to fathom why this would be interesting to anybody.
Not a big apparel guy. Just put a shirt and shorts on and go out and play. And that's as much as I think about that.
All right. Well, there's a lot of people that, you know, don't share your views when it comes to the aesthetic and jerseys, kits, whatever you want to call them out there. And when you look at it historically, I think that this is interesting because you're with an apparel company in not just a business capacity. I mean, you are intertwined when it comes to Adidas and the German national team for 70 years. So something dramatic has to happen to sever that relationship. And so after 26, they will go with Nike for, like I said, somebody different for the first time in 7 decades. I just think that is amazing because when you think of Germany and when you think of German athletics, it is intertwined and always has been historically with Adidas as a company. And it is obviously, you know, been associated with German teams, with German players for so long that it's going to be a little strange to see Nike. But, you know, they probably paid them a whole lot of money and, you know, times change. So we'll see ultimately what it looks like. But as far as Adidas goes, you only got a couple more years. And who knows, maybe this summer a championship, and then who knows what happens in 2026.
The only sports apparel deal I care about is Michigan's association with the Jordan brand, which means that Michael Jordan goes to our games now. He was there for the national championship game in football, so that was pretty cool.
I mean, your Brazil team, it's just variations on yellow or blue, right?
For people that care about this, Brazil just launched a new kit with the crest in the middle and the 5 stars directly above. How do you feel about that?
I wish the U.S. had done the same, because as great as the result was yesterday against Mexico, I thought that the white jerseys were boring and plain and were an unused piece of real estate that I just wanted a big American flag or a big crest right down the middle of it. So not happy with those white ones. I like the shorts. I thought the shorts were good, but I didn't like the white shirts. Where should we go now?
Last thing in this beefy opening segment, we found out the groups for the Olympics for the U.S. men and women. The men are in a group with host France, New Zealand, and then either Guinea or an Asian team. We don't know that yet. The big news with France, Real Madrid put out a statement saying they will not be releasing any players for the Olympics, which impacts Tchouaméni, Camavinga, and we all think Mbappe, who presumably will join Real Madrid this summer. So the U.S. could catch a break there.
Yeah, and so they are not required to release anything because they're not official FIFA. It's not an official FIFA tournament. However, the pull of playing in the Olympics for all players, and I would think also in your own country when it comes to Mbappe or something like that, would be great. But if you just kind of blanket and say, no, that's not going to happen, it takes a lot of the speculation off. Keep in mind that you get 3 overage players, players that are over the age of 23 at the time of the Olympics. So we will see that play out from a U.S. perspective also. And it'll be interesting to see who U.S. feels is mature and good enough to be one of those three players. Back in the day, back in the 1900s, I was actually in the 96 Olympics, one of the three overage players.
The women are in a group with Germany, Australia, and Zambia or Morocco. Keep in mind with the women, it's 12 teams, three groups of four. The top two in each group and the two best third place finishers advance to the knockout stage. So you really have to screw up to not make it. Nevertheless, this is a tough group.
And 18 player rosters too. So, yep. It'll be interesting. And again, it'll be the first time that we see this team in, you know, a big tournament. We saw them earlier in the W Gold Cup. Is that what we're calling it?
Yep.
In a big summer tournament since the World Cup, she believes is coming up. But look, I think a lot of focus when it comes to Emma Hayes and this new generation, if you will, of U.S. Women's National Team will be focused on what happens in this Olympics. Anything else, my friend?
That is it.
All right, let's take another quick break. When we come back, we got some MLS action. Don't go anywhere.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Okay, welcome back. While we know we're in an international window here, believe it or not, there was MLS action. Where should we start, my friend?
Yeah, we already have replacement refs. We had replacement players this weekend because so many were away on international duty. We begin with the Red Bulls hammering Inter Miami 4-0 in the rain. Lewis Morgan with a hat trick against his former team, Carmona, got the other.
No Messi, but that had nothing to do with anything other than quote-unquote injury out there. But we had just gotten done saying that Miami had learned how to play without Messi and believe in themselves without Messi. This was, from start to finish, a complete, you know, rainstorm. It just did not stop. But that didn't stop the Red Bulls. They looked awesome. And they came out and they smashed Miami. We were just talking about aesthetics and everything like that. The red and the pink, why couldn't somebody wear white out there or something to offset it? Because it was distracting. But Red Bulls don't care. Big, big win and big, big statement win for New York.
Cincinnati 1-0 over NYCFC. Reigning league MVP Lucho Acosta with a sensational goal.
I mean, the dude is, he's so good and his wonderful low center of gravity and the quickness and then his ability to think about things and get into difficult or get out of difficult situations and to put people in. 60 goals, 80 assists for him. Seventh player in league history to do so for Lucho Acosta. So big win. And as good as the red side of MLS is when it comes to Red Bull, still struggles when it comes to the blue side with NYCFC.
Charlotte 2-0 over Columbus. Westwood and Ajimang with the goals late. This match was a refereeing apocalypse. Derek Jones got a bogus red card. Charlotte were gifted a ludicrous penalty, which they skied. Cucho had a goal weirdly called back. So the crew really had a gripe here. And this game came days after Tom Bogert wrote a piece about how players and coaches around the league are reaching their breaking point with the replacement ref. So this did not help.
All right, so give them money that they want, right? I will say when it comes to the adding of time, it confuses me when people get angry about that you are actually being given the soccer that you paid for, the soccer that you come for, as opposed to people rolling around on the field, people wasting time, or the ball actually not in play. What else, Masi?
The Galaxy with an incredible come-from-behind win over SKC. Radoya and Agada had given SKC a 2-0 lead, but then Zavaleta made it 2-1. Jovalic 2-2, assisted by Ricky Puig. And then Delgado, a goal that stood up after a VAR review. So the Galaxy take it 3-2.
Remember a few years ago when we interviewed Jovalic, and he just had that money quote. I remember him being next to Rob Stone and just seeing Rob Stone's face light up. It was after a game. We were at the, I guess what it'd be called, Dignity Health now. And he basically said, I am the future. And he was believing in himself, but also, you know, a premonition, if you will. And he is on fire right now. And this LA Galaxy team is back in terms of being relevant and in terms of, I don't know, say dominant yet. But again, shame on SKC for letting this one get away from them. But well done, Greg Vanney and company, for coming back.
Yeah, Jovalich, joint top scorer in the league with 5 goals. A lot of people question with Chicharito leaving, the Galaxy not going out and signing a big-name center forward, but they trusted him, and so far he's repaying that faith.
Every game, right? He scored in.
Yep.
Good for him. Good for him. All right, let's go to the other side of Los Angeles.
Yes, LAFC with a 5-0 demolition of Nashville. Buanga scored twice. Tillman, Oliveira, and Atuesta got the others. They needed this result, and yeah. Buanga needed these 2 goals.
Yeah, Buanga, he missed a bunch, too. I mean, he could have had more, but you just felt that this was both pent up individually when it comes to Buanga, but also pent up from LAFC. And Nashville was the one that took the brunt as it just exploded out. And it got away from Nashville early on, and it was never even close. So this is the type of LAFC that a lot of people were predicting they would see. And if rumors are to be believed, they could possibly get much better. I guess, I mean, Giroud is good. Is he great?
Well, let me set that up.
Okay.
So they already have the reigning Golden Boot winner, Buanga. And if rumors are to be believed, they're going to be adding some goal scoring in the summer. Fabrizio Romano reporting today they are the favorites to land Olivier Giroud, which would mean they would have France's all-time caps leader, Hugo Lloris, and France's all-time leading scorer, Olivier Giroud. Giroud right now playing alongside Christian Pulisic at AC Milan. He's 37, turns 38 in September, but still playing at a high level. So that would be an interesting pickup.
LAFC, the French connection. Off we go. All right, I'm here for it. Anything else, Muscle?
That is it.
All right, another quick break. When we come back, it's time for Ask Alexa.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for Ask Alexi, that part of the show where you send in your questions, comments, and concerns. Please use that hashtag Ask Alexi on all the social media platforms. And keep in mind that on social media, our handle is SOTU with Alexi, or you can call into our State of the Union podcast hotline, which is 657-549-2297, 657-549-2297. Mossy, what do the folks want to know this episode?
First up, a question on X. Santiago Almeida asks, why doesn't MLS play Copa Libertadores or Copa Sudamericana?
Ooh, interesting. Well, I want to get your take. But before I do that, you know, we were talking earlier about the pendulum swinging and the U.S. being so dominant in CONCACAF right now. And it got me thinking about, you know, we talk about college athletics and college football and teams just going to different conferences and, you know, trading up or whatever. If the U.S., to your point, wanted to play more consistently against better and elite opposition, it would make sense for them to, you know, pull off and maybe join something like CONMEBOL. And I guess the same applies for MLS teams in terms of the quality that they would face, but I'm not sure if it's feasible. And in doing so, you are letting down your members and obviously your confederation and your area of the world, and you're trading up.
Absolutely. This chatter is in the air. We have the Copa America this summer with CONMEBOL and CONCACAF teams. I saw some chatter last night about perhaps a CONMEBOL CONCACAF Nations League. And the conversation is taking place at club level as well. Keep in mind, at some point this year, they want to have this Copa Interamericana. I'm not sure the dates yet, but it's a Final Four with the Leagues Cup winner, CCC winner, and then the Libertadores and Copa Sudamericana winner. So the matchups would be Fluminense and Inter Miami, León and LDU Quito, and then the winners would square off and kind of a fun Final Four. So that would be sort of the first step towards that. And yeah, the tricky thing is finding space in the calendar. What would that mean for MLS teams' involvement in CONCACAF competitions? Would it diminish those competitions too much? So you have to balance all that out. But generally speaking, I would love to see it. I think it'd be a positive.
You know, if it's just to give some perspective, UEFA, if I have this correct, is 55 full members. if CONCACAF and CONMEBOL merge, CONCACAF is 41, and obviously CONMEBOL is 10. So you'd go to 51. So if they merge, they would still be less membership than the full UEFA membership. So who knows? That could be something that's happening. But, you know, I think right now, you know, I mentioned I was in Dallas with the CONCACAF folks, including the, you know, president, Victor Montaliani. You know, his job and CONCACAF's job is to do what's right for all of their membership and to grow CONCACAF, not to grow CONMEBOL. Now, they're using CONMEBOL to help grow, but it would be really interesting if both of these confederations came together and created a super federation or a super confederation here. But from a membership perspective, would that be something that people want? Well, it comes down to if they're going to make more money. If you went to some of these minnows and some of these teams in CONCACAF and said, you know what, while you might not be playing in some of these major tournaments against the best teams within your confederation, you're also going to make more money. And would they go for that?
Another question on X, at New Kids World Cup asks, honestly curious what it's like to play after getting beer thrown on you, assuming it's beer and not .. formerly beer. Most players say they shrug the stuff off, but it does seem gross.
Yeah. So, you know, when you play for the U.S. men's national, I mean, if you play for any length of period, you very quickly learn and accept that, you know, when you go, well, first off, when you go to certain markets, and especially when you play against a team like Mexico in the U.S., you're playing an away game at home. And certainly when you go out of country into a lot of these other countries, you know, you're going to be faced with not just 11 players on the other side that want to crush you, but a stadium and a country and culture that wants the opportunity to beat you. And part of it is understandable because you arrive as America with all of that baggage and all of that history. And in many cases, it's that one chance for them to get one over on the United States. Now, it manifests in a bunch of different ways, including, you know, let's be honest, and we've talked about it over the years. You know, I and anybody that's played for the U.S. for any length of time at some point, whether it's home or away, people throw stuff at you. And whether it's beer, whether it's batteries, whether it's urine, whether it's coins, whether it's bolts, the list goes on and on and on about things that get thrown at you. I always approached it with a kind of a punk ethos in that I don't care if you love me or hate me. I don't want you to be ambivalent. I want to be able to elicit a reaction because I take control in that instance. And so, you know, whether it's spitting or throwing or doing all that kind of stuff, let it rain down. I bathed in it and I loved it because, you know, I wanted to send those people home that were doing that with a loss. And I wanted to ruin that day for them. And whether we were in the U.S. and in my own country, I was getting stuff thrown at me or booed, or whether we were someplace else, I wanted to harness that. And I did harness that energy. I know a lot of people have, you know, Landon Donovan, and the list goes on and on and on. And so I really, it's a strange word to use, but I enjoyed that type of environment. And maybe it's playing a heel or whatever, you know, that character that you inhabit in that moment. Yeah, I liked it. And I do think that most players, they shrug it off, and it's almost a rite of passage now. And I'm not encouraging anybody to do it. It's wrong. It can be dangerous. It can actually be criminal in terms of doing that. But again, you have thousands and thousands of people together. They would do things that they wouldn't normally do if they're walking next to you on the street. And it plays out in a lot of different ways. And we see it often.
I remember when I was young, I attended a Columbia USA friendly at Rutgers Stadium. and I sat in the Colombian fan section, and they were heckling you the whole game. Yes. I always think about that now, ironically, since I work with you.
I've been heckled in the greatest venues in the world. I remember being in old Wembley playing against England, and every single time I touched the ball, I'm screaming and yelling and doing all that kind of stuff. But it comes with the territory.
The context there, I think in the lead up to the game, you called Alan Shearer overrated.
It's very possible. I don't know. It's the previous century. Speaking of problems and altercations, can I get a shout out to a U.S. fan that was at, and there weren't many of them, but a shout out to a U.S. fan who was at the game this weekend. I mean, this guy took it for the team, as you can see there. So not only did he get what I think amounts to 7 stitches, bloodied all over the place, but that blood spilled onto, if you can see this, and if you're watching, and if you can't, I'll describe it to you, a glorious, glorious uniform, kit, jersey, whatever you want to call it. It is the 94 denim that this young man was wearing when he was hit by whatever he was hit by. Blood pouring down all over his face. He took it for the team. He took it for the United States. And I salute him. And as a 94er, if you will, I think I am confident in saying that you are now part of this fraternity. We are making you part of the 1994 team for what you had to go through. And people said, well, he messed up his shirt. No, this is now something to be valued even more so. A 94 denim shirt that now has the blood of an American that will always be there and will mean that you went to that, you not only saw the U.S. beat our major rival in Mexico, but you bled. You bled for this team and you bled for this country. So congratulations, and I salute you, your denim jersey, and thank you on behalf of a grateful America. All right, should we take another quick break, my friend?
Yep.
All right, we'll come back. It's time for my one for the road. Okay, welcome back. It's the end of our show, and at the end of each and every show, I give you my one for the road. And as Mossy alluded to earlier in the show, I wanted to kind of talk about this U.S.-Mexico rivalry, what it is and maybe what it isn't. But I know you had something that you wanted to set this up with.
Yeah, I mean, the furor in the internet had just died down from your MLS mid-table comments. I mean, you hit everybody with U.S.-Mexico is the greatest international soccer rivalry, which is something you've said before. Mm-hmm. Not everybody agrees. Here's Max Brados chiming in on that. We have to retire the debate on whether USA-Mexico is the best rivalry in soccer. It's a special matchup, but the percentage of Americans who care about the sport here disqualifies it.
Hmm. I love Max. I disagree that it... Well, first off, I disagree that it disqualifies it. You may think that there are others that are better, but I don't think it disqualifies it. I actually think that when you're talking about this, and I'll reiterate why I think it's the best in the world. So first off, there is a history. There is this pendulum that goes back and forth. And while we may find ourselves in this, it's not rarefied air because it has swung back and forth before, but in this moment of incredibly positive play on the field and obviously results, it can very easily swing back. As a matter of fact, we used to talk about the gap and the gap widening and closing when it comes to Mexico. And notwithstanding what Mossy said earlier in the show about what, the mentality of Mexico, especially relative to Liga MX and Europe, don't think for a second that this can't change. And this can't change very, 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 very quickly. But when you look at this rivalry, obviously the proximity of our two nations, obviously the history that we have, not just when it comes to on the field, but off the field, the history that we have, the intersection and the threads that go between these two countries and cultures, and how much we are influenced and we are affected in the things that we do from a day-to-day basis, whether it is our language. You joked earlier about the change in culture and the change in language relative to the English language here in the United States, whether it is our politics. Each and every day, there is something political that you can reference relative to the country of Mexico and the United States. Whether it is our culture when it comes to entertainment and music and movies, and the list goes on and on and on. And then obviously when it comes to sport and this back and forth. And that's why I think it is the best. I know Max doesn't have a a purity test or a passion test when it comes to fans and cultures out there, because I would put up Mexican fans or U.S. men's national teams fans with the best, whatever his best are in the world. Now, if it's all about size, and Max, you should know it's not just about size, but if it is all about size, then fine. If it's about actual passion, if it's about history, it's about intensity, if it's about this pendulum that swings back and forth, it's about excitement, all of these different things, I absolutely think that US-Mexico is number one around the world. And there are others, and you know, it's arguable, and I can certainly be convinced. But just because the U.S. has now dominated for a period of time, I don't think you throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to the greatest rivalry in the world, which I still think, Max Bretos, and to anybody else out there, is USA-Mexico.
Can I push back on that
sure.
a little bit? I agree with you. The social, cultural, political elements of it elevate it. But in a discussion about the best soccer rivalry, the soccer has to count for something.
Why?
And you're talking about two middling nations that have never come close to winning a World Cup, while Brazil and Argentina are two Mount Rushmore footballing nations that have combined to win 8 World Cups, Pelé, Maradona, etc. It would be like me saying Fenerbahce Galatasaray is a greater rivalry than Real Madrid Barcelona because of the cultural components of it. It's a bit of a stretch to me.
Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying, but I don't. Just because they have a longer history or they have been better on the field from a soccer playing perspective doesn't disqualify the U.S. from providing incredible moments. That's like saying
an
artist who's
sure.
been around and had 10, you know, platinum albums, all right, that a song from somebody who just came out with their first album can't be equally as good as anything that has happened in that 10-year or that 10-album existence catalog.
So your contention is that in the year 2024, a U.S.-Mexico game is a bigger occasion than a Brazil-Argentina match when you take all the different factors into account.
Yeah, I think for U.S.-Mexico fans, it is. Now, for the greater country, and especially when it comes to the United States involved, I will readily admit that there are other countries that game resonates and permeates through the country and culture much more so than this one does here. But for American soccer fans and Mexican soccer fans, this is everything. It obviously it's bragging rights, but again, it goes into all of the different things and all of the different connections that we have and continue to have.
It would be like comparing a dinky rivalry like USC, UCLA to Michigan, Ohio State. It doesn't work.
Oh, of course. Listen to you. All right, listen, well, let us know. You can agree or certainly disagree and let us know. And maybe we'll have some answers when it comes to either social media responses or our State of the Union podcast hotline. Anything before we go, my friend?
Yeah, I just want to sneak in one last thing. We've given shout outs on this pod to Max Bretos, Chris Whittingham, Tony Miola. I do want to shout out Eric Winolda. They put out a clip of my Berhalter comments. People were arguing about it, and he came in and said, this is actually a really good take by Mossy, and that lent some credibility and weight to it. So
it did.
I appreciate it.
I think he also said, my guy, right? He loves you.
That's right.
Well, I mean, what's not to love? But no, you're my guy now. What are you talking about? Oh, boy, oh, boy.
That is such a fun element of your rivalry. You know, you're former roommates. You have this love-hate relationship, and you've both worked with me on air, so it's delicious.
Well, I mean, look, we might have, you know, different opinions on a lot of different things out there, but when it comes to surrounding ourselves with quality, I think we both agree that you can be, much worse when it comes to the great David Mossy. So thank you for gracing us both with your presence over the years. And thank you for gracing us with your presence when it comes to the State of the Union podcast. Keep reviewing and downloading and subscribing and doing all the different things that you do. We're back again later on this week with another show. Keep sending in your questions using that Ask Alexi hashtag or our State of the Union podcast hotline, which is 657-549-2297. Like I said, we'll talk to you again later this week. And until then, and as always, my friends, size the day.